You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. Today we talk again about personalized medicines. And in this part two with Thomas Debray, we talk about the typical hurdles that you need to overcome in order to get to more personalized medicine. So stay tuned, and now some music. Lots of the things that you will need in order to driving personalized medicine forward are part of the Effective Statistician Academy. If you yourself have something to contribute to this academy, something that is about this topic or any other topic, and you would love to bring this knowledge more to the world, then just reach out to me. I'm always looking for trainers that just want to come with their content, and I take on everything else. Yeah, I want to make it really, really easy for trainers to share the knowledge and to provide more impact into our community. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. I'm super happy to have again Thomas Debray on the show. He has been on the show already sometimes, and last time we dive deeper into personalized medicine, and today we want to continue on that and speak about the challenges around that and also the most promising opportunities on that. So great to have you back. Let's start with the typical hurdles. What do you think are the main challenges when it comes into personalized medicine?
Yeah, I think one of the key challenges, of course, developing these strategies to personalize treatment strategies, because research is not really designed to, or studies, I should say, studies are not really designed to come up with answers for individual patients. And maybe one exception would be crossover trials, but you know, then again, those results would not directly be generalizable to new patients. So I would say the biggest challenge is really to get data that allows you to say something about individual patients and how they would benefit from treatment.
Mm-hmm. Crossover studies are special because they are, the different patients get all the different treatment options. And so you can much better see within patient differences.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the idea of a crossover trial, by the way, is not really to learn about individual treatment effects, but it is kind of an efficient design to expose, indeed, like you said, patients to multiple treatments so that you can still learn about relative effects while minimizing, I think, the variable that usually you have between individuals if you would do like a parallel design.
Yeah, it's a great design if you have the right indications to do it in.
Yeah, and indeed, and at the end of the day, the goal is still to obtain relative treatment effects. But I mean, in theory, you can learn about individual treatment effects about the patients in your trial. So, I mean, it's a design that kind of connects right with the personalized medicine IDs, but it's not a design that is, I would say, suitable to really start implementing personalized medicine.
So when you think about, let's say, the typical phase 3 study, yeah, you have standard of care and the new treatment, or maybe you have something like standard of care plus placebo, standard of care plus an active comparator, and standard of care with plus the new treatment. Why is that design so bad to kind of personalize it?
You mean a standard parallel design, just randomized?
Yeah.
Yeah, because trials, I would say the trials are usually powered to, you know, to obtain relative treatment effects. So they are, you know, when you design a trial, you do like one of the critical steps is to like a sample size calculation to decide how many patients am I going to include in my trial. And typically you would power your trial so that, you know, you have a certain expectation about the effect of your treatments. And then you power your trial so that you can kind of demonstrate, right, that effect is indeed there. Now, in theory, you could power your trial to demonstrate like effects in different, let's say, subgroups, right? To demonstrate, look, I have a treatment effect of this magnitude in males and a treatment effect of that magnitude in females, or maybe in smaller subgroups where, you know, you stratify by, I don't know, like 5, 6, 7 covariates. So in theory, you could do that, but you will find out quite quickly that the sample size that you need and to establish efficacy in all these, you know, small specific subgroups is going to inflate your randomized trial by a huge amount. And so it's not something that sponsors would usually pursue for various reasons. So, I mean, in general, the objective for a trial is to demonstrate that the treatment works. The goal is not to demonstrate what the effect is in different people with different, you know, type of background indications.
Yeah. That is, I think there is one other case. You would have different comparators based on where you are. Yeah. So, and I've seen that then very often you have multiple studies. Yeah. So you have one study, let's say naive patients, another study in pre-treated patients, another study in patients with a specific comorbidity, another study into patients that need a very specific supportive care, things like that. Yeah. And then you have lots of different studies. Yeah. Not just one study. If you have that kind of part, is that something that is helps you to more personalize it?
I mean, so if we plan to develop these models, you need to start personalizing treatment decisions. I mean, yes, you need, I would say, heterogeneous data, right? You need data and evidence, right, for how the treatment works in different type of populations. So, like you say, if I would only have data from a single trial, let's say the trial is like very big somehow, but you only included need like patients who have like, for example, no history of prior medication, you know, then in terms of generalizability of whatever model I'm going to develop in that set of patients is going to be, you know, it's going to be limited by who I enrolled in the trial. And usually, of course, on top of that, usually in trials, I mean, the type of patients you include is always a specific type of patients, right? You don't just start selecting patients from clinical practice, you know, and just randomly including them in your trial. Usually there is some kind of selection process there on top of the specific type of restrictions that you already had in mind in your trial. So yes, I mean, having trials from multiple indications or multiple, let's say, background comorbidities, I mean, it's going to help you, right, to kind of build a profile of subpopulations. Then that kind of, you know, individually they may only like cover a specific subset of the population where you want to, you know, target your drug. But if you have like multiple trials that like cover different subsets, you know, if you globally consider this set of trials, you may still not, of course, capture the entire population that you had in mind, but the coverage, right, will be much better than the coverage of a single trial, whatever the size of that single trial may have been.
Yeah, I see that point. If you talk about heterogeneity in terms of, I think you talk about heterogeneity in terms of the patient population, in terms of where the patients are coming from. Is that correct?
Yeah, so where the patients are coming from, so not only geographical heterogeneity, but also in risk profile, right? And I mean, just how they look, how the disease manifests itself to some extent, right? I mean, there's always a question of how much heterogeneity do you want, but a certain level of heterogeneity is definitely good to develop like statistical models that have a degree of generalizability.
In which variables are really important to have variability in at baseline?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So in terms of efficacy, I mean, the key variables that drive the treatment response, the treatment-covariate interactions, right? That covariates that affect the magnitude of your treatment effect. So definitely you would want variability in those covariates, but I would argue that you would also want variability in covariates that maybe don't affect the efficacy of your treatment, or at least covariates where you're not sure, but at least having that variability will help you to understand that there is no effect modification in by these covariates. So it will also help you to kind of robustify your opinion, right, about the generalizability of your models, because all these models that you're developing, you can validate them. Of course, you can get some estimates of performance, but you know, then you will still have some questions, right, about, okay, how is this model going to perform in the next patient or tomorrow, right? Today it works, does it work tomorrow? So, you know, to build some kind of confidence in the performance of these models, you need a certain degree of variability, and either variability that affects the performance of your model or that affects the efficacy of your treatment, or variability that doesn't, but where, you know, you suspect that it might have an impact.
Yeah. And so when we think about these models that predict our treatment effects based on the covariates at baseline that we have, then of course we want to have variability in those that have an effect and that we know basically from our studies, from the biological history, plausibility, just to have them for sure. Also those that potentially have an impact. And of course, this kind of, you know, this is not a yes or no kind of thing. Yeah. There is very often it's a, yes, this covariate has some effect and this has a big effect and this has potentially only a very small effect. And so it's great to have variability in all these different baseline variables. Now, when you talk about models, from my understanding, there's a couple of different steps in terms of building trust to develop these different models. When I first started at university, my approach was just to, okay, I throw in all the variables, then I run a model across all the different patients I have, and then I get a result. However, this is not the best way to do it for a couple of different reasons. What are these reasons that I shouldn't kind of develop a model like what I just described?
Yeah, I think we can learn a lot from prognostic models, which are already quite common. So prognostic models are models where you just want to predict progression, right? So regardless of treatment, so everything status quo. So you just have a group of patients. You're not going to start intervening things, but you just have a group of patients that are maybe receiving a certain standard of care or maybe not receiving a certain type of treatment, but you just predict what's going to happen. So common examples are models for cardiovascular disease, you know, where you would predict, you know, like unfavorable outcomes within, you know, on a time span of 10 years. And then, you know, those predictions are used to inform decision making and still decide upon treatments. And you also have models for, you know, like predicting the outcome after surgery and so forth and so forth. So, but the main findings, I mean, so a lot of research has been done in this area, right? And how these models are developed is, like you say, right, often they would conduct an observational study or maybe a randomized trial. They would use the data and they would indeed just, you know, feed the data into an algorithm like a GLM, you know, like a logistic regression model or maybe a survival model or maybe some fancy machine learning model. And they would like maybe inform a bit the selection of covariates, but a lot of things are data driven, right? They just use an algorithm to figure out which variables go in, which variables go out. And then they publish these models, potentially with some claims that they work great or without any claims. And I mean, what we've learned over the past few decades is that many of these models, they always perform much worse than anticipated. So I've not seen many models that actually perform as good or even better than was originally claimed. And the recurrent problems is that, yeah, challenges in as far as the data collection, right? Which data is used? So how representative is that data for the population that we have in mind? All these data-driven type of approaches are very sensitive to chance findings, right? Like kind of random decisions, basically, by the algorithm that are driven by the data. And then also the efforts made to kind of assess the performance of these models is often suboptimal. So there's many deficiencies in this process. And that's just for models where we don't even try to predict how patients benefit from treatment. That's just models that try to predict, you know, what's the future risk of developing a certain outcome, regardless, you know, I mean, status quo. And these models are used actually to define also to identify individual treatment effect, because often these models are used, for example, to, you know, you'd have this prediction like, my risk of developing an MI, for example, within the next year is, 20%. And then you have the result from your trial, you know, statins, you know, reduce my risk by a hazard ratio of, 0.8. So you apply the 0.8 to my absolute risk and there's your so-called individual treatment effect. So that's kind of the implicit kind of way of thinking that is not that uncommon, but it's based on a lot of, you know, loose pieces of evidence that you assume that they all connect very well, that they, you know, that you can apply that relative effect to this absolute risk and that all these things make sense and can be added. And it's all on the assumption that all these pieces of evidence are correct, are valid, but also that they are compatible, right? And there, I think there's a lot of, how do you say that, you know, extrapolating your confidence, right? Quite a bit, stretching it quite a bit far.
Yep.
So that's just my experience so far.
So what would be your advice in terms of building these such models in the first place? There's these things like training data set and test data set and things like that. Can you speak a little bit more about what that means from a model building perspective?
Yeah, so from model building perspective, so the key challenge is that unlike prognostic models where we just want to have it's a sort of descriptive model, right? It's not really a causal model, it's a descriptive model. So prognostic models, the recommendation is that, you know, you want an observational study because it's a representative sample of your target population. Now for the prediction model for treatment benefits, it becomes much more complex because we're interested in causal prediction. And that means that we need to have data where we can learn causal effects. So, you know, basically we would definitely benefit from leveraging data from randomized trials to develop these models. But at the same time, data from randomized trials might not be sufficient because the patients in your randomized trials are typically not representative of your, they are representative, but they're not like directly exchangeable, right, with your target population. So certain model parameters, they cannot properly be estimated from randomized trials. And you need observational data to make that translation, right? Like to really translate how these risk estimates or these causal effects would apply to individuals that you see in clinical practice. And so essentially you would need a mixture of both randomized and observational data to complement, right, the missing pieces of information that you have. So the randomized trials that give you evidence on relative treatment effects, right, on causal effects that apply on population level. Observational data is giving you evidence about, you know, baseline risk, to some extent also about treatment covariate interactions. Although, yeah, I mean, to some extent, it also gives you information that you can learn from randomized trials, but the cost of learning that information is much higher in observational studies than it is in randomized trials. And then, so ideally you would have this, and then ideally you also have like patients from observational studies, randomized trials that are, you know, that kind of cover all this kind of subpopulation that you have in mind, right? Because if you develop these models, you hope that you can apply them then afterwards in clinical practice. But then the question is, okay, which clinical practice, right? Is it just one practice in one specific country, or, you know, do you have the ambition to, you know, to also start using it on a more global scale, right? Like maybe everywhere in Europe. And then also one question would be like, you can apply it today, but what about tomorrow? Does it still work? Or after, you know, new interventions or standard of care is changing and so forth. So there's a lot of dynamic elements in this whole, in this whole landscape, right? So you have the data is a big challenge, but even if you have like the perfect data for your model, there's still other challenges that have to be considered that relates. Yeah. At the end of the day, I would say that relate to generalizability, right? So generalizability is not only a fixed property, it's also a dynamic property of models.
Yes, that's a good aspect of clinical practice changes over time, for sure. When you speak about observational data, lots of people first think in terms of observational data, then I also run a single-arm observational study where all the patients get my new treatment, and that's great. My marketing and sales colleague loves this type of study as well. So let's run such a one-armed, single-arm observational study directly after we get the drug on the market. Would these one-armed studies help with predicting models?
To a limited extent. I mean, they will only give you indication about prognosis in patients exposed to your active drug. But you would need to, I mean, at the end of the day, you would like also to have information on all the comparators, right? Especially if you want to individualize treatment effect, you want to understand what are these contrasts, right? What are all these other treatments that are relevant, that are available, and how would patient benefit if they were to take, you know, one of those drugs? And so to have this type of evidence, I mean, yeah, you would either have a randomized trial with multiple arms, but yeah, your power is going to be very limited to do a lot of sophisticated analysis with that. or you could learn from like electronic healthcare record data or observational studies or other type of observational sources to see in like patients who are currently being treated with these alternative treatments. You know, how is the drug working in those patients? And I mean, at the same time, you might also realize that the efficacy or the effectiveness of these drugs that you observe in observational data sources might not always correspond to the efficacy estimates that were, you know, reported in the initial trials. So then you have additional questions, right? Like, why are these discrepancies there? Is it because of adherence? Is it because of interactions with the treatments? So there's a lot of other type of modifiers that can affect these estimates. We will be becoming more aware of these things as well with the all estimates framework, where you also start thinking more explicitly about, okay, when we say treatment effect, what do we mean by treatment effect? You know, what are we talking about? And you know, this is already quite challenging when dealing with randomized trials, but it is even more challenging to define treatment effects when dealing with observational studies, where what we call in a randomized trial intercurrent events. I mean, observational world is full of, you know, unplanned type of things that are happening at the start of treatment, but also after treatment and so forth.
So one apt observational study doesn't work.
It would be an expensive study. I mean, you would have to set up ideally prospective observational study, multi-center, you know, where you collect all the data and all the relevant data at the relevant time point. So in theory, it's possible, but in practice, it may not be the most efficient way to achieve that goal.
What would you think is the best best is probably the wrong word. So the most efficient way to get to something like a good model.
Yeah. So my impression is that the most efficient way would be to leverage existing data sources as much as possible. While identifying the gaps that are there in the evidence that is there, and then to prospectively design studies to kind of fill that gap. But I think, I mean, this might not always work in the sense that there's still a lot of, when you look at observational data, I mean, there's a lot of variety, right? In the quality, but also the operationalization, right? Like some standards. I mean, standards are becoming more prevalent. But if you have like studies that all adopt very different ways of defining endpoints or defining certain disease conditions or comorbidities and so forth, it's adding a lot of noise in the whole process. And, you know, if you start mingling then data across data sources that are not like standardized in a similar fashion, you will end up, you have a high risk of identifying like effects or interactions that are not really there, but that are either kind of reflecting some discrepancies between your data sources. So if you want to avoid all these problems and to like really effectively, you know, like put your pieces of evidence together like a puzzle, you know, like they actually, you don't have to force the puzzle together, but they actually fit together. Standardization is going to be a key element in that. And of course, for clinical trials, they already have standardization schemes and it's very rigorous and very well defined, but observational studies, standardization, I mean, it's coming. I mean, there are like now you have OMOP and some other formats, but I don't know to what extent it's currently implemented. And I think there's still a lot of gains that can be made to really make like observational data sources much more, you know, not exchangeable, but, you know, like compatible with one another, but also compatible with evidence from randomized trials. And so I would say that's kind of a problem of infrastructure, I think, right? Unless infrastructure. So I think there's a lot of gains that would have to be made, but they are being made. So that's one element. And the other element would be the methods, right, to kind of put all these pieces together. But I think, so we are getting there. And I really think that the most efficient way to develop these models to start looking at individual treatment effects is to really leverage these data sources and to basically map, right, which evidence is out there, how do these pieces of evidence connect? So we have our randomized trials. We have maybe a single arm study. We know there is a registry in that country. We know that this hospital is doing an observational study. You know, so what, you know, what is this evidence telling us, right? As individual pieces, what is missing to, you know, to start connecting these different data sources? Can we, you know, maybe we need to run a specific type of study. Maybe we need to start like either a prospective cohort study, or maybe we want to do a study where we work with some, you know, PROs or, you know, like wearable devices to collect some very specific endpoints that we have a sparsity of data. And then, you know, once you have all these different pieces of studies or different pieces of data, then you can start working on statistics to kind of, you know, to integrate all these data sources in a rigorous fashion, but also to understand, okay, what are the risks, right, of putting this data together what's the quality? How much confidence can I have in the result that come out of these analysis? And that, I mean, statistics is only a part of it. It's a very important part, but it's not everything, right? That's my point.
Yeah. I've worked with combining studies. Yeah. Multiple studies, even from the same sponsor, done over a period of time in the same indication, and you can still have variability. Yeah. So if you have standardized outcomes, if you have standardized descriptions of important baseline covariates, yeah, that makes a huge difference, makes things so much easier. And that is definitely an area where anyone working in a specific indication, a specific therapeutic area could greatly help, yeah? Push forward standardization and these kinds of things. And standardization within clinical trials, so within all the different clinical trials across different sponsors, and also to make these data capture, the way of how you capture the data as compatible with real-world settings as possible. So that whenever you have an observational study or registry or something like this, you can reuse the same variables that you used in your clinical trials.
And yeah, I'm out there, but for randomized trial, we often look at clinical endpoints, right? But it would make sense, even though they're not powered to start looking at PROs and things like that, but it would be helpful to collect some of these big PROs in clinical trials, because it will make it also easier to start mapping that piece of evidence with observational studies where you might actually have more like this kind of soft endpoints being collected than in the clinical trials.
Yeah. So that's a good advice. Yeah. Just because in your specific studies that you're thinking about, you might not see a difference. Thinking it from a holistic point of view of all the different evidence that you can accumulate over time, all these kind of different parts will sum up to relevant difference, to relevant evidence. And so, yeah, think beyond your study for sure. When we think about these kind of settings, I'm pretty sure there will be indications where it's easier to implement these thoughts that we just have, and other indications where it will be much harder. What do you think are indications that are most promising of putting this into reality?
Yeah, I would say it's indications where it's relatively easy to, you know, to obtain large amounts of data, right? Where indications where data is already being, data collection is already part of like healthcare processes, where trials are relatively large, but yeah, the challenge is, of course, that when trials are large, it means that treatment effects are small. So it's not necessarily the easiest setting. But yeah, I think I would say, look, indications where the treatment is quite uniquely defined, right? Where you have like well-established treatments that are, you know, like not very complex, where, you know, the treatment is a process, but rather where the treatment is kind of one intervention, right? Where you take treatment today and then maybe the outcome happens only, you know, the outcome of interest is not happening like 20 years down the road, but it's also relatively short to the. So yeah, I think to give a label on that, I don't know, but I wouldn't say like rare diseases. I think rare disease is going to be a challenge, for example, because already just learning about relative effects is a challenge in rare disease. So, you know, let alone about individual treatment effects.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I also agree. It is where you can observe something rather fast. Yeah. Big patient population, and where you can very easily measure the effects. Yeah. So especially kind of the patients can measure the effects themselves. Yeah. And just thinking about, for example, obesity. Yeah. Well, measuring weight is pretty straightforward. Yeah. You don't need kind of your highly sophisticated radiological whatsoever stuff. Pretty much everybody has, weigh themselves at home, can record that. These things are super easy. Things where you have specific radiographic interfaces, where you need ratings from a physician. These things are, especially as these ratings from physicians differ very often between clinical practice and clinical trials. For example, if you think about depression, There's highly sophisticated tools that you use within clinical trials that are usually not used in the clinical practice. There, as you said, the PROs could help quite a lot. Okay, thanks so much for this great discussion about personalized medicine. We touched on lots of hurdles that are there in terms of study design, what data to capture, how to capture the data, how to build the models, up to even kind of what are the indications that are really, really interesting. And so we'll definitely have lots of further episodes that we can record on all these different aspects and further aspects on personalized medicine. For the key takeaway for the listener, Thomas, what would you say is the, you know, the most important thing from this episode that people should take away and take home?
Well, I think I would say two things, right? Opportunity and risk, I would say, right? So this is I think it's a huge opportunity in personalized medicine with all the, you know, data being accumulated increasingly often. We have increasingly access to large amounts of data and also increased ability to connect pieces of evidence. So I think this opens a lot of opportunities to start looking further than relative effects and really start looking at personalized, individualized treatment effects. So I think there's, you know, like a new era, you know, coming up where we're going to see a lot of new, you know, new types of advanced analytics trying to, you know, investigate individual treatment effects. So that's the opportunity side. On the risk side, I would say, like, look, the development of these models and understanding of their performance is far from straightforward. It may look simple in the sense that, you know, you have data, you just run an algorithm on the data. So, I mean, I could explain it like that. And yes, you can do that. But the chance that such an algorithm is going to be, you know, giving you like reliable and solid and valid estimate of individualized treatment effects is, I would say it's very small. It's a lot of hurdles, you know, to make it work, to have the right data, also to understand that you have the right data, to understand what data is missing. So it requires quite a bit of thinking to do it properly. And so there, I think, you know, that's one of the big challenges, which I think will also decrease over time as, you know, we get access to better data, access to better standards and so forth. But while we're getting there, I mean, you know, be careful. My takeaway is, you know, be careful developing these models and be aware of the limitations that you're dealing with.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Model development is definitely a very, very interesting thing. And we'll definitely have some episodes about this coming up in the future. Thanks so much, Thomas, for another great episode.
Thank you.
If you have not yet discovered the Effective Statistician Academy and what it all entails, and if you haven't heard that you can actually contribute to this academy as a speaker, as a trainer, then just head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and you will find a link to the academy there. This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who help with the show in the background. And thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective